I'm going to begin in Daniel chapter 9. We referenced this last night, but it was toward the end, and I don't know how well we referenced it, although I think what we said will stand up. But the question was asked a little bit about the tribulation, where they get passages for the tribulation. And the answer is there just aren't a whole lot. Now, in Matthew chapter 24 that we looked at earlier in the week, you find references in verse 21 and in verse 29 that I mentioned about the tribulation. But we spent quite a bit of time, or at least discussing how those verses, I am firmly convinced, are in reference to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. So I can't use those passages as justification for the concept of the tribulation. Now, tribulation, the word is used numerous times in the Bible. But most of those times, I think it's fairly obvious that it has reference to a specific event of trial and trouble in various nations. And we referenced Daniel last night. And in the ninth chapter, we were referencing the 70 weeks prophecy, which I believe, and I think most people, most people believe that that was a prophetic prediction of when Christ would come. And you know, it's kind of interesting. When you go to Matthew chapter 2, the wise men, that came looking for Jesus, how did they know to come? Well, you know, God could have just told them. And I speculate on this a little bit, but the wise men, the actual word there is magi that is used. And those men would have come from the area of Babylon where Daniel was. And I wonder if Daniel hadn't, in his prophecy, maybe it had been written down and the wise men had figured out about the time Jesus was going to come. Because in the prophecy there, a day equals a year. That's kind of a common theme that we see throughout Revelations, and we see it throughout the prophecy here in Daniel 9. So you've got 70 weeks, which was 490 days, and 69 of those weeks, or 483 years, would have occurred from the time that the temple was reestablished in Ezra and Nehemiah's day until the birth of Christ. And it kind of depends on what date we can put to it. But if you go back and look through history, that it is awfully close, and it gets you right up into that 29-30 AD era. But then you've got that extra week, and we were talking about that last night, that some people take that week as to be a futuristic week, and that's where they get the 7 years of tribulation. If you look here in chapter 9, and I don't know that we turned to chapter 9 last night, and we certainly didn't read it, but I wanted to go and look at, I'm going to begin in verse 24 of Daniel chapter 9 and just read a couple of verses. This is the prophecy. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision of prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore the temple in Jerusalem, that's when these 490 days, that's when the clock started ticking, if you will, and that was probably around 457 B.C., some people would say 455, but it's right in that area. That's when this prophecy clock, if you will, starts ticking. So if you go up 483 years from then, you're right at the beginning of the ministry of Christ. Verse 25, and know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, or the 69 weeks, and the wall even in a troublesome time. And after 62 weeks shall the Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the Prince shall come and shall destroy the city and the sanctuary and the end thereof. So we've got the cutting off at the end of that period of the Messiah. Verse 27, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of that week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation, to cease. Halfway through that final week, sacrifices and oblations were to quit. Well, when did sacrifices and oblation no longer mean anything? Well, it was at the death of, it was at Calvary and the establishment of the church when the law was nailed to the cross. So that's what I was talking about last night when I was talking about halfway through that last week or 3.5 years through that 7 years. I believe that's when we have the death of Christ, and then probably the other 3.5 years take us up to the conversion of Cornelius in Acts chapter 10 and repeated in 11, which would be the inclusion of the Gentiles. So, my point being that I don't believe that week or 7 year period fits a tribulation period at the end of time. Deuteronomy chapter 4 verse 30 talks a little bit about a tribulation, but it's not in reference to the end of time. So, Matthew 24 and Daniel chapter 9 are the two places where you're most likely to find people looking for scriptural support for the idea of a 7 years of tribulation prior or after the millennial kingdom. There are different views of that. Some are pre-tribs, some are post-tribs. Pre-trib means the tribulation comes before the thousand-year kingdom, and post-trib means it comes afterwards. There are different people read it differently. But I think we can, at least I feel confident, we can look at those passages and understand them more clearly as reference to other things and not to that tribulation period. But I think it was Tom who asked the question, well, surely they get it from somewhere. And that's a valid comment. This is where they get it from, as best I can tell. I don't agree with it. I think it's fairly easy to look at those passages and understand them probably more clearly in a different way, but that would probably be the passages that I would know of that they would go to. Does anybody have a comment or a question on that or anything else we talked about in regard to that last night or anything I've talked about this week, because we're kind of tie some loose ends up tonight? Okay. We mentioned also, and a comment was made to me, Tim and I were talking after church, and I thought it was a very good comment he made. Back in Revelation 7, when it talks about the 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, which gets us to the 144, and Tim, if I don't paraphrase what we were talking about, improve it or correct it, but I thought it was a good point. The 12,000 was not necessarily a specific number. There's not going to be 12,000 Jews from this tribe, 12,000 from that tribe. But it also carries that idea of they all had equal opportunity. One tribe didn't have 20,000 and the other one have 1,000. They all had equal opportunity. And I think that's an excellent point to make, and one that we didn't make, or I didn't make last night. Later in that seventh chapter in Revelations, it talks about there being a whole multitude in heaven, which I take to be encompassing not simply the Jews, which were in those 12,000 times 12, but to be the Gentiles that made up the multitude. 144,000 might be a multitude, but it certainly reads later in that chapter that heaven will have far more than 144,000 people in it. And that makes sense because we know that the Gentiles, we all hope that the Gentiles, will add to whatever Jewish number there is in heaven, because most, if not all of us, probably fall into the category of being Gentiles. Does anyone care to have a comment or a question or a follow-up on that discussion that we had last night? Okay. I thought we might just take a moment, too, to talk about the Antichrist. We hear a lot about the Antichrist as it relates to the end times. John is the only writer that mentions or uses that particular terminology, and he uses it in 1 John, and then he uses it in 2 John. So I'm turning to 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, which is the first time in which John uses it. I'm going to read each verse that John uses relative to the Antichrist, and then give you my thoughts as to what that might mean or whom it might be. Because often in reference to discussions of the end time, people today are thinking, well, who is the Antichrist? is that person the Antichrist? Is that a sign of the end of times? In 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, John says, "Little children, it is the last time, and ye have heard that Antichrist shall come. Even now are there many Antichrists. Thereby we know that it is the last time." Well, I think that verse has, first of all, something very significant in that it says there are many Antichrists, which takes me out of the thought of there is simply one Antichrist. Now, there's been a lot of books written and classes taught and discussions about, well, maybe the Antichrist is Muhammad, maybe it is a pope, maybe it's Saddam, maybe it's, and you fill in the blank. And it's possible that all of those could be Antichrist, because to me an Antichrist is simply someone who is against Christ. And so, by definition, I think there have been a lot of Antichrists, and John here uses it in the plural. If you drop down to verse 22, he gives us somewhat of a definition. "Who is a liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ? He is an Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son." If you deny God and if you deny Jesus is his Son, you're acting as an Antichrist, or you are against Christ. Now, this book, I think, underlying context for the writing of this book was the early church's battle with Gnosticism. And Gnosticism had several beliefs about Christ, but one of the beliefs that they had is that Christ did not really come in the flesh. It's called the docetic doctrine of the Gnostics. They didn't believe Christ came in the flesh. They simply believed he seemed to be here in the flesh. And docetos is the Greek word for seemed or seemed to be. So they denied that Jesus actually had come in the flesh. It just seemed like he was there. There was another group within the Gnostic doctrine, and I believe they were called the Cerinthians. They believed that Jesus came, They believed that the Messiah came, but he wasn't always with Jesus. Their belief was that Jesus became the Messiah, or God placed his Son in Jesus at the baptism. Remember, the Lord said, "This is my Son, in whom I am well pleased." And then they believed that sonship or that Son Spirit left Jesus before the crucifixion, because they contended that God couldn't die. Well, God can't die, but the humanity of God placed in Jesus was able to die in one sense of the word. I only bring those up because those were some of the Antichrist type of doctrines that I believe John was specifically trying to address. We don't have those doctrines predominantly bombarding us today. There are a lot of people that don't believe in Christ as the Son of God, but not in the same way of the Gnostics. So here in verse 22, when it says, "He is a liar that denieth that Jesus is the Christ, he denieth the Father and the Son," I think the context of the Gnostic heresy is probably a good underlayment for that. The next time that John mentions Antichrist is in chapter 4, verse 3. "Every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh," remember what I just said about Gnosticism, the docetics proclaim that Jesus didn't really come in the flesh because God is good, flesh is bad, and God and flesh therefore can't commingle. "Every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus cometh in the flesh is not of God, and this is the spirit of Antichrist." Now, he's not calling anyone an Antichrist there. He's simply saying that is the spirit. That's the tenor of someone who is against Christ. And again, I think he's primarily in the first century talking to Gnostics, but it has reference to us. The last time John mentions it is found in 2 John, verse 7. In 2 John, verse 7, he says, "For many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Jesus is come in the flesh. This is the deceiver and an antichrist." So the issue here is that if you deceive and do not accept that Jesus came in the flesh, you are an antichrist. So with those four references that we have to Antichrist in the New Testament and the way that it seems to be presented in its context, I simply believe an Antichrist is really anybody who denies Christ And by definition, that seems so obvious. So I don't personally look for a particular person as being the Antichrist in a singular form. So I don't really look for Muhammad or the papal system or Saddam or whomever, Gaddafi, as being an Antichrist. Those all may well be Antichrists. But to say, well, because that person's on the scene, we're now at the end, near the end of time, I think would be a tremendous leap of intellectual difficulty that I can't make. Now, in 2 Thessalonians, it does talk about the son of perdition, and that seems to have reference for some of the apostate church leaders, the papal system, but that's certainly not the only Antichrist. I think it's possible in a sense, for any of us to be Antichrist, and if you're Antichrist, you're Antichrist. Nobody had asked me about the Antichrist, but I thought maybe it would be appropriate to touch on it tonight, since it often comes up in end time considerations. Does anybody have a comment? Maybe you can add to that, or improve on it, or you have a question. Michael?
We have a new guy tonight. I think I wore out Lowell.
That's all right.
Anyway, you mentioned in that reading there that John said that the Antichrist of his time was evidence that we are in the end times. Now that sounds like, on the surface, that he expected Jesus to come soon. But the reality is that after Jesus' death and the establishment of the church, that brought on the end times, which we are still in.
Okay. Yeah, the King James that I was reading from, and you are correct, Tom, the specific wordage is, we know that it is the last time. And I believe it's quite probable, if not almost provable, but that many in the early church expected Christ to come back in their lifetime. And there are passages that if I had been living in the first century, I might well have thought that also. In hindsight, looking back, we can look at those passages and see them in a little different light. But the passage that I've referenced several times, and we may get to tonight in 1 Thessalonians 4, I think that book was largely written because the people thought maybe they had missed the second coming, and Paul was saying, no, you haven't missed it, just chill out. He didn't say chill out, but that was his sense. But he doesn't scold them. He doesn't scold them. He just says it hasn't happened. Now I believe here when in John, 1 John 2 and 18, when it says we shall know that this is the last time, hindsight's great. I think what he's saying is we're now in the last dispensation. But he doesn't say how long that last dispensation's going to last. And so far it's lasted 2,000 years, and it may last 10 more minutes, and it may last 2,000 more years. We just do not know. And I think that's, well, I know that's good because that's the way God set it up. But my mind was just thinking, how would we react if we knew he was coming next week? Well, you might say, that'd be good because we'd really work this week. And that's true. But human nature being like it was, a lot of us would have procrastinated till about now, thinking, okay, now let's put on the afterburners the last week, and the rest of our lives might have been a little less productive. So I'm sure there's great wisdom in that. Thank you. Anybody else have a comment or a question on anything we've talked about? Specifically now we're looking at the Antichrist. Her comment was, would an Antichrist be the same as an atheist? I don't know if I'll say everyone, but I can't think of one that wouldn't. I think atheists would be Antichrist, so in that sense they would be, but I believe there are people who probably believe in God the Father that reject Christ, so you might also say that. So you could be maybe an Antichrist and not strictly an atheist, but an atheist would certainly fall into that category almost all the time. In my thinking, I don't know how to put them in any other category, Bev.
Well,
I don't know how to put them in any other category. Anybody else? Comment or question? Okay. This next section won't last very long. I just found it to be fun. Some of the signs that people have come up to help figure out when the end of time has come. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 4. And I don't mean this to be flippant, and we can all make mistakes, but how many of us are saying the books of the Bible to remember where Nahum's at now? Did I say Nehemiah? Okay, my bad. Nahum. Now you can say the books of the Bible. Sometimes when I'm drilling the kids in VBS class, we'll have a contest, and I'll give them book, chapter, verse, and see who can find it the first. Well, both those minor prophets are you scramble. Nahum, chapter 2, verse 4. The chariots shall rage in the streets, and they shall jostle one another on the broad ways, and they shall seem like torches, and they shall run like the lightning. One man felt that when automobiles finally had headlights, that was a sign of the end time, because chariots had these torches. Well, you know, that's kind of silly, but that's one that I ran across as I was looking at some things. Let me find another one here real quickly, if I can. There we go. This man equates this, one man equated this verse to airplanes. Joel chapter 2, verse 5. Like the noise of chariots on the tops of mountains shall they leap, like the noise of a flame from fire that devoureth the stubble, as the strong people set in battle array. You know, it's just amazing. If you want to find something in the Bible, I guess you can make it say it, but the noise of chariots on the tops of mountains. So this person took the position that the invention of airplanes was a sign of the end times. Well, I think we've had enough time pass that we've probably figured out that that wasn't it. And each theory that comes up, I think, probably falls under the weight of the passage that says, no man knoweth the day or the hour. So we just obviously need to be ready. Does anybody have a comment or a question on anything we've talked about this week that you would like for me to spend a little bit more time on? I can go back and introduce some other thoughts and look at some other passages, but I want this to be for you and whatever is most productive for you. Okay, I'm going to go now to 2 Timothy chapter 3. We looked at 2 Timothy chapter 4 the other night, and we may look at that in just a moment. But in 2 Timothy chapter 3, the first six or seven verses give us some indications of things that will be occurring as we near the last days. But they are important, but they are so generally encompassing, because I think every age has dealt with these things, that it really doesn't give us the time, and we know that. But I thought it was worth us taking a look at 2 Timothy chapter 3, and I'm going to read the first seven verses. This know also, that in the last days, and that may again be a reference to the last dispensation, perilous times shall come. So he wanted people to understand that things were going to get bad before the Lord came. Men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. I'm going to pause there because it's always struck me that he would put disobedient to parents and unthankful in the same category as some of these other things. Now, I think we would all accept being disobedient to our parents and not being thankful for what we have is wrong, but to put it in the same category, but God doesn't have categories. He has good and he has bad. Verse 3, without natural affection, we see hear a lot about that today, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent or people that don't have any self-control, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures, more than lovers of God. Well, we sure see that. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, hypocrites. From such turn away. For of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women, laden with sins, led away with diverse lusts, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. I think verse 6 has a particular pointed warning that I have to remind myself of, and I would like for us all to, how they creep in to houses. Very similar to what we have seen in some of our other passages in 1 Timothy chapter 4, I believe it was, about seducing spirits. You know, oftentimes these things don't come upon us in an obvious way. They creep in. They're kind of like termites. By the time they're there, if you're not looking for them, they can cause a great, great deal of harm. And he's giving a very strict and stern warning here regarding things to look for as the days proceed on. Anybody want to make a comment on anything in that passage? Okay, I'm now going to go to Matthew chapter 25. In Matthew chapter 25, again, we spent quite a bit of time in Matthew 24, but as we go into the latter part of Matthew chapter 25, there's just some real good imagery and articulation of the second coming. Okay? And I'm going to begin looking at verse 31. To the end of the chapter. Matthew 25, 31. When the Son of Man shall come in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him. So when Jesus comes back, the second, final time, He's going to come with an angelic host, and then He shall sit upon the throne of His glory, and behold, and before Him, pardon me, shall be gathered all nations, and He shall separate them one from another as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. This is the judgment day. Now, I mentioned the other night that I believe when we die, we know whether we're saved or not. The story of Lazarus and the rich man indicates that when they both died, they knew. If that's the case, then why have a judgment day? If you know when you die whether you're going to whether you have gone to paradise or to Tartarus or a place of punishment, then why later when Jesus comes have a judgment day? Well, I think there's a couple of reasons to consider. Some people believe in soul sleep because they just believe we won't know until the judgment day, but I can't reconcile that with some of the other passages. I think the judgment day serves at least two very, very important things, even though I believe we will know. Number one, it will be a public sentencing. And the whole world for eternity will know whether John Lee hears, "Well done, good and faithful servant," or whether John Lee hears, "Depart, I never knew you." So there is a public element to this. And the second part, which is equally, if not even more important, prior to the judgment day, we will not have our spiritual bodies. We will be souls and spirits in paradise and in the place of torment, whichever place we are at. But until the resurrection, which occurs with the second coming of Christ, we will not yet have our spiritual bodies. So at the judgment day, I believe there will be the reunion of our soul and spirit, which has gone on to paradise or to Tartarus, with our resurrected spiritual bodies. So judgment day will not only be a public judgment, but it'll also be a reunion of ourselves into our spiritual bodies, and then we'll be whole. Hopefully we'll be whole in heaven, but I guess you could be whole in the sense of your body, soul, and spirit all being condemned to hell. So I think the judgment day still has a very important element to manifest itself, even though I personally believe that the moment we die, the second we die, the nanosecond we die, whenever that is, because we're always redefining what is death, but it's when our soul and spirit leaves our body, I believe we will know. And as I said the other night, I believe those that are saved, the angels will carry that soul and spirit, not the body, but that soul and spirit to paradise. No indication in Luke on the Lazarus and the rich man that the soul and spirit of those who aren't saved will have any kind of escort at all. If they do, it certainly wouldn't be a godly escort. Does Does anybody want to comment about that, or the judgment day, or what happens in our transition from death to the judgment day? I'll just open it up. I don't know if you have any questions on that or not. You got Ryan, Randy, and Marvin, if I saw the hands correctly.
What would you say to those people who would go and say, well, our soul will be either in heaven or in hell, so therefore it's not going to be the same as though we are present in our human body, so the pain would be different versus what we experience now?
Well, I would point to them that at the judgment day, our bodies are resurrected and our soul and spirits are reunited. So in the judgment day, you will be Ryan, soul, spirit, and spiritual body, whatever form that takes. So there's a reunion of that, not a separation of that. Now in terms of, I believe your spiritual body will be either in heaven to enjoy the fruits of that, or in torment to feel that sense. But I would take them to Luke and the rich man and the Lazarus. The rich man says, I'm thirsty. You know, he just wanted a drop on his tongue. And, you know, that's not going to do much for thirst. He was that desperate. He says, please go back and warn my brothers. You know, he had memory. All of his senses were there. His hearing, his sight, his speech, his touch, his nerve endings, they were all there in some way, shape, or form. So I just don't know how you get around that and other passages. You can say, well, I don't believe that. And that's okay. I mean, if you want to say that, but you've got to say, I don't believe the Bible if you take that position. So that would be my 30 words or more answer. If I had to guess, fire will hurt more then than it does now, because I think our senses will be more alert, which will make heaven better and hell worse. Now, I'm giving you opinion when I say that. If you ask me, where's a chapter and a verse that says your senses will be greater? But when you move past some of the limitations of this physical earth, I think we'll be more sensual. And I don't mean bad sensual. I just mean I think our senses will be more alive and more alert. Randy?
Okay, my comment is about the judgment after we already know where we're going when we die. I'm not saying I disagree with you, but it's kind of a question in my mind. Why is anybody going to care whether so and so is going to hell or heaven? Because you're either so scared about what you're ready to be told, or you're so happy about what you're about ready to be told that you probably really don't care about what anybody else's fate is.
I think there's some reason to what you just said. I think probably it will add to the punishment of those who don't go to heaven to see what they could have had. My personal opinion, and I want to differentiate opinion before rather than something I can prove, is that one of the great punishments of hell is they will be able to look up into heaven and see what they missed. And the rich man was able to do that, look up into paradise and see what... Now, we don't have any reference that in paradise they look down, because that would probably cause sorrow. But there may be an element to the judgment day, Randy, of those who are told, depart, I never knew you, will have to endure seeing what they could have had. And that may be part of their mental punishment as well. I just don't know if at the judgment day we will know each other so that you'll know whether I make it or I know whether you make it. I don't know that. I think in heaven we'll know each other, and I think in hell they'll know each other. But whether that is something reserved for the time we're in heaven or not, You could say, well, I won't care, but it seems like righteous people would care if someone doesn't make it, even though when they get to heaven, their tears are going to be wiped away and there'll be no sorrow. So it is a bit of a quandary. It is a bit of a quandary. Anybody want to comment on Randy's question or comment? Go ahead and get Marvin, and then we'll... I thought I saw another hand, but...
Someone has explained it that in paradise, you know that you're convicted if you haven't lived for Christ, and you know what the judgment is going to be. You know the law, and therefore you know whether you stand or fall under that law. But once it's pronounced by the judge, there's no question about it.
Yeah. I don't want to change the wordage in the Bible, but it helps me to, in this context, to think of the judgment day as not when I find out, but it's the formal sentencing. And I've probably used this analogy. I've probably used it here. When we die, it's like the jury. We know it, guilty or innocent, but the judgment day is when the judge pronounces sentence and says, "Depart." So, but there are people who believe, well, we'll just not be alert. We won't be aware once we die until the judgment day, so we won't know. It's called soul sleep. And it used to be very predominant. I don't know why Christ would have given us Lazarus and the rich man story if that's the truth. I think we will know. There's an article, and I forget the gentleman that wrote it. It's entitled, "One Second After You Died." The whole premise of it is, and I think it has a biblical background. You know. But you can't change it, which makes condemnation so difficult to bear. Anybody else have a comment or a question that you would like to make?
Yeah, John.
I'm sorry, Mike.
Your public sentencing?
Yes.
What's your basis for that?
Well, here it said that all the nations shall be gathered together. I think I just read it. Yeah. In Matthew 25:32, before him shall be gathered all nations. Everybody from all ages is going to be gathered in that great judgment scene. And then he's going to separate them. So I think everyone who's ever lived will be there. Everybody who's ever lived will be there. I don't think, it doesn't read to me like he's going to say, "Okay, John, come in this little room and you and I are going to talk and I'm going to tell you." I mean, if he wants to do it that way, but I think it'll be public. I think it will be public based on this.
As for the attributes of our heavenly person, whatever you want to describe it as, the soul, the remainder after the death of the body, you know, it talks about there's no darkness, therefore we must be able to perceive, we have sight, there's no tears. That implies that you have emotion, and go on and on. Whether we will be as we, you know, have our consciousness that we have now. As you say, if we can see those that we love are in hell, then that would imply that there would be some sorrow. So there must be some differences in us, but to think that just because you're changed, you're not going to endure joy or pain because it's something else is, you know, it's just silly, I think. The other aspect, you know, you talk about the public pronouncement of at the judgment. You know, to me, it of necessity would have to be instantaneous in our, even though we are the only ones that perceive time.
Yeah.
For God and Jesus, their time is meaningless. But, and the reason, I mean, for example, if Jesus took a second per person, I think I read somewhere that so far there's been 100 billion people that live on the and maybe I'm making that up, but it's a very, very large.
It's a whole
large,
bunch.
It's a bunch.
It's a bunch.
So if you even spend a second
per
person, it would, you know, it would take, in like, again, in our perception, time. So to me, I think it's going to be that nanosecond that you spoke of. He will be able to judge all, if I'm not making that number up, all 100 billion.
Yeah, it's when you start trying to figure out what it's going to be like when there is no time, that's above all our pay grades. We can't think that way, because I don't think there's any past, present, and future for God. Well, if you take that, then everything happens. It seems as if everything happens at the same time. But my mind can't grasp that, because God made us time oriented. But I believe by the time we get to the judgment day, as Tom alluded to, time will no longer exist. So, you know, if he takes 1 second per person, there won't be any seconds. So, but we got eternity to do it. So it's a wonderful thing to think about, and 'tis a puzzle just to grasp it, just the awe and the magnificence of it. But I don't think that the judgment day will be a pro. If time existed and he took 1 second per person, it wouldn't be the judgment day. It'd be the judgment month or the judgment year. It'd take that long. Well, that's not what he means. No one's implying that. It's just the majesty of God is just sends a chill up my spine. Charles.
I guess a couple things I was thinking about was I was trying to locate the verse that I thought implied that it will, whatever is done will be revealed. That public thing you're talking about, that whatever man has done will be revealed, that everybody will know it at the sentencing. The other thing I was thinking about too is, I think there's some references in Revelations maybe too of there being something about judgment that has to do with God's justice and God's righteousness, even though the people may know their sentence before they're sentenced, that's important for God to go through that process, because that's part of Him being righteous and just. And the martyrs who have gone before, it talks about in Revelations, you know, their blood's going to be accounted for.
Okay, thank you. Well, I believe there will be a literal judgment day. So don't misunderstand what I'm getting ready to say. But yet, at the same time, the whole wordage of judgment day may be God trying to give us something we could get a handle on when the reality is so much beyond our ability to grasp in many aspects. But that does not mean I do not believe there will be a literal judgment day. But that whole statement is a little odd, because if I said time has already stopped, how can I talk about a day? But there will be a judgment. Well, I started to say a judgment time. I can't even say that. There will be a judgment. How's that? And it's just this whole subject of time is that's deep, and it's probably deep enough that we're not going to figure it out this side of Jordan. But we've only got so much time here on earth. We understand that. To do what we need to do to be ready for when the Lord comes. Does anybody have a closing comment? I'm going to ring the bell because the teachers want a little bit of time. But you know, I often ask myself, well, if it's hard for us to get a handle on, why did God spend so much time talking about it? And it must be that He wants us to focus in a preparatory way to be ready. I think no matter how good my understanding of the end of time is or isn't, it won't be exactly like each one of us thinks, because we're just not smart enough. But the main thing is that we know that it occurs, and that we know that the end of time is not the end of existence. That's very important. People who are not ready for the Lord will wish that the end of time meant the end of existence, but it doesn't. And they will struggle. Anybody have a closing question or comment you would like to make as the kids come? We did not get to 1 Thessalonians 4 to do an exegesis of it, but I would point you to verses 13 through 18, which are some of the most concise verses as to exactly how it will be when Jesus comes and the process, the trumpet, the archangel coming with him, the resurrection of the saints. It's just a wonderful, wonderful imagery that for a Christian should always be uplifting. Should always be uplifting.